Hello. On this week's program, David Patrick Stearns reports from the Netherlands on performances by the Philadelphia-based Piffero at the prestigious Utrecht Early Music Festival. Jason Pfeiffer takes a look at Latino arts and culture in Philadelphia as the North Kensington neighborhood prepares to celebrate the 25th annual Ferio del Barrio, the festival of the community, this weekend. And Susan Lewis looks at an upcoming exhibition commemorating the 225th anniversary of the Treaty of Paris at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts in collaboration with the American Revolution Center. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Piffero, Philadelphia's Renaissance wind band, tuning up at the Utrecht Early Music Festival. This 10-day crucible of music, which runs through tomorrow, is devoted this year to the Spanish Renaissance, or various recreations of it. In 135 events, one of the most popular being Piffero's latest collaboration with the popular Belgian vocal group Capilla Flamenca, which rarely plays to an empty seat. Together they performed a late 15th century mass by Cristobal de Morales to a packed cathedral in what was easily one of the highlights of the festival, but one that had some morbid surprises. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns reports now from the Netherlands.
Tracking down Piffero, the Philadelphia-based Renaissance wind band, in the winding brick streets of Utrecht is not too terribly difficult, even amid the dense scheduling of the Utrecht Early Music Festival. You follow the Grand Canal, the one that was dug by Romans, watch for the Domkerk, the large cathedral in town, and listen for the procession of bagpipes, the ones that are perfectly in tune. That could only be Piffero.
The occasion is a Requiem Mass by Cristobal de Morales, the great 16th century Spanish composer, in a reconstruction that includes not just the Mass's musical peaks, but the ceremonial elements as well. The project was devised by Capilla Flamenca, the distinctive, celebrated Belgian vocal group that has worked with Piffero often in the past, and asked to again. It's a period that Piffero particularly loves. The Spanish Renaissance gives wind players a lot to do, often in the form of intense polyphony, marvelous rhythms, and rich chords, say artistic directors Joan Kimball and Robert Rubin. They could play nothing but that period and be perfectly happy.
The vitality of Spanish music and the intensity of the polyphony are enough to keep bringing us back to the repertoire.
I think also the fact that we know we have indications of the fact that there were a lot of chant players and brass players in Spain that played this repertoire. And there's some wonderful quotations from Guerrero, was one of the composers that we play in our show, who talked specifically about the wind players in the wind band at the cathedral in Seville. And we sort of know them by name as well. And there's something sort of fun about playing the repertoire that they played.
You know them by name. That's cool.
Roja and Lopez were the two top-line players.
Though Piffero also played a solo concert in Utrecht, the Capilla Flamenca performance was the eighth and most ambitious collaboration between the two groups. Prior to their dress rehearsal at Utrecht's Domkerk, Capilla's artistic director, Dirk Snellings, explained that he works with Piffero partly because he enjoys the group's congenial personalities, but mainly he admires the group's democratic, conductor-free way of music making, with each member listening to the polyphonic lines and, in particular, interacting with the singers and what they're out to convey.
They work very hard, and we feel it on the way singers like to sing. I mean, they always want to stay very close to the text. The text has an accentuation, the text has meaning, of course, very important. and so all the phrasing of their articulation is very close to what we are doing as singers, indeed, very important.
Though Piffero's Renaissance music niche in Philadelphia is a unique and sometimes lonely one, there's nothing lonely about visiting Utrecht. As Piffero was packing up its instruments after rehearsal, Krista Patton talked about how one of the most important lessons is learning to play the music in the kind of churches where it was originally heard.
I learn how to make the sound of my instrument engage the acoustics of the space. In other words, you create a sound that, and then you in effect are playing the church as your resonator. So that's really informative, and then that informs the tempo and the kinds of articulations that you make, and how long you hold a chord so that it sounds in the space. All sorts of ensemble things. It's the last link in the process of reconstructing pieces.
Well, with conventional musicians, they just lay on more vibrato. But you can't do that, can you?
The vibrato police come and find us if we do that.
Getting closer to the source of the music had a few twists this time. As much as Joan Kimball believes that presenting sacred Renaissance music in some semblance of liturgical context increases emotional intensity, she was incredulous when, halfway through the dress rehearsal with Capilla Flamenca, what appeared to be a glass coffin, reminiscent of Sleeping Beauty, was placed center stage. Would there be anything in it? No. In the original Requiem services for the great Charles V, the coffin was basically symbolic. Even royal remains, due to hygienic issues in warm weather countries, needed to be disposed of. That symbolic presence was recreated on Thursday with appropriate black draping and 6 fat candles to focus the listener's attention on what the music is about. But that significance was lost on many. Cathedrals often lack good sight lines, and the musicians all claimed to be concentrating so hard on the moment at hand that this extra piece of atmosphere wasn't a factor in the performance. I could argue with that. The very idea of an empty glass coffin is so strange, so not of our time, that a psychological impact had been made. Did the musicians project some unconscious awareness of the gravity that symbol implied? How could they not? Such historic details, whether centuries-old customs or authentic instrument tunings, can make a performance click into place on a much higher level. And that click definitely happened on Thursday, leaving you in an emotional place you've maybe never visited, somewhere between here and the 16th century and every memorial service you've ever attended. It's a concept that's worth bringing home.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns reporting from the Utrecht Early Music Festival in the Netherlands. Piffero's 2008-09 season begins with concerts in Center City and Chestnut Hill, Philadelphia, and in Wilmington, Delaware on October 24th, 25th, and 26th. Tomorrow, a Philadelphia neighborhood hosts its annual Feria del Barrio, the Festival of the Community. This year marks the 25th anniversary of the event, which celebrates Puerto Rican and Latino arts and culture. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the afternoon of programming highlights a vibrant part of the city.
According to the 2006 census, people of Hispanic or Latino origin make up about 10% of Philadelphia's population. Concentrations of the Latino community are scattered throughout the region. In South Philadelphia, Olney, Hunting Park, and the Kensington neighborhood surrounding the intersection of 5th Street and Lehigh Avenue. Rafael Zapata is director of the Intercultural Center at Swarthmore College and board chair of Taller Puertorriqueño, the 34-year-old North Philadelphia organization whose goal is to use arts as a vehicle for social change in the Latino community. Standing at the 5th and Lehigh intersection where Feria del Barrio will be held tomorrow, Zapata explains that a winding, faded yellow pathway painted on the sidewalk of North 5th Street marks what's called in English the Golden Block.
El Centro de Oro, or kind of a loose translation for Main Street, right? This is where you come, this is the center, and it's, in addition, it's always been known as the heart of the Puerto Rican Latino community. So this is where people come when they want to find food, culture, services.
A New York native whose family is from Puerto Rico, Zapata moved to Philadelphia in 1995. Feria del Barrio was one of his first entrees to the Philadelphia Latino community, an event that quickly made the area feel like home.
It's the festival of the community. Feria del Barrio is basically an opportunity for people from the neighborhood to come together and listen to our art and our culture.
Organized by Taller Puerto Riqueño in collaboration with a handful of other community groups, the festival includes dance performances, art and craft booths, food, games, and music. This year's headliner is Hector Tricoche. In a city beset with problems like poor education, crime, and poverty, an event like Feria and arts in general nourish a community, says Jesse Bermudez, executive director of AMLA, Artists and Musicians of Latin America. Bermudez, who was involved with Feria for about 15 years, observes eager anticipation for the annual celebration.
Every year you'll see them out there waiting to see what talent is there, and not just solely artists from the outside, but making sure that our local artists got an opportunity in those festivals to showcase themselves also.
Community festivals like Feria del Barrio are familiar to many Latinos, according to Carmen Fabo San Miguel, executive director of Taller Puerto Riqueño.
Outside festivals are very much a part of our cultural heritage and the way in which we celebrate our arts and our important events and our history.
As organizers program the festival each year, Fabo San Miguel says they look to reflect the diversity of Philadelphia's Latino community with the music, dance, and art that's included.
Puerto Rico and Mexico and Colombia, I mean, we try to give a flavor, obviously, of not every country, but of a mixture and the variety of folkloric styles that we have.
Fabo San Miguel says when Feria was started in the early 1980s, in conjunction with the unveiling of a mural, it drew just a few hundred people. But Johnny Irizarry, director of the University of Pennsylvania's La Casa Latina, a center designed to develop greater awareness of Latino issues and culture, says the festival soon developed into an important, culturally grounded tradition for the community.
It was playing a pivotal historical role because at that time, the Latino community didn't have many outlets to promote its music and its culture.
Irizarry, a former executive director of Taller Puerto Riqueño, says when Feria was started, a sizable Latino community in Philadelphia was already well established, though many from Latin America have been settling in the city for centuries, dating back to the days when Philadelphia was an important colonial port. A large-scale migration took place after World War II. Initially, most came from Puerto Rico in response to the employment needs of the Philadelphia region and unemployment on the island. According to Irizarry, as the local Latino population has grown over the last 60 years, the community's presence in Philadelphia has had a notable influence on the arts and culture of the city. For instance, Latino clubs and restaurants have cropped up all over the region, and Philadelphia has forged a reputation as the city of murals. Influenced by the Mexican muralist movement, murals were painted in local Latino neighborhoods in the late 70s, contributing to Philadelphia's emergence as a model for public beautification and engaging underprivileged youth to create murals.
Because in Latin America and the Caribbean, art is perceived as a daily act of life, right? So, which is also really interesting and why it's hard to get Latinos to consider the concept of coming to a place to pay for art. That whole very European-centered way of, you know, sitting down in an audience and being passive while art is given to you. Latinos are used to this participation engagement, and no matter how poor you were, I think that that's something that the city has adopted.
Irizarry says an annual event like Feria is a reminder for the Latino community that they have a local history to remember and a rich heritage to celebrate. For the Philadelphia community at large, the 25th year of Feria del Barrio is also a milestone that commemorates a significant Latino contribution to the city's arts and culture landscape.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The 25th annual Feria del Barrio will be held tomorrow afternoon at the intersection of 5th Street and Lehigh Avenue in North Philadelphia. Although the signing of the Declaration of Independence led to the July 4th national holiday, less attention is paid to the Treaty of Paris, which ended the American War for Independence on September 3, 1783. In marking the treaty's anniversary, the country's oldest museum and school has joined forces with a new history museum still fighting for a permanent home. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis goes behind the front lines of peace, liberty and independence 225 years after the Treaty of Paris, an exhibition that explores the role that art played in shaping the course of the American Revolution.
Colonists clanging the Liberty Bell, George Washington crossing the Delaware, courageous members of the Continental Army trekking shoeless through the snow. Although every student of American history has images of the freedom fighters who waged the war for independence from Britain, artists are probably not the first who come to mind. But there was a reason General George Washington took time off from the battlefield to pose for Charles Wilson Peale in 1779.
Art was used for its political value and its social value to promote the cause of the American Revolution.
Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts director David Brigham says art was integral to the war effort and cites Peale's full-length portrait of Washington featured in this exhibition as a prime example. Commissioned by the Pennsylvania Supreme Executive Council after victories at the critical battles of Trenton and Princeton, the 8-foot-high painting shows Washington in military uniform. Brigham says Peale used the grand manner of British aristocratic portraiture, but adapted it to a style more appropriate for the new republic.
He creates a George Washington at ease. He gazes back at the viewer and he's got a gentle smile, rather than the more aloof or distant look that you would expect in an aristocratic portrait.
The portrait hung in the Pennsylvania State House, known today as Independence Hall, where it could be seen by the public, boost morale, and inspire fundraising for the war. It also spawned dozens of other portraits, many of which were painted by Charles Wilson Peale and his sons.
It became almost a family industry to paint portraits of Washington from this official life portrait in 1779. But it also became a national symbol that was disseminated throughout North America and throughout the world.
As the exhibition Peace, Liberty, and Independence, 225 years after the Treaty of Paris, makes clear, the war on American soil drew interest and support from other parts of the world. Tom Daly is the CEO of the American Revolution Center, which aims to tell the story of the war in all its complexities.
France nearly bankrupt itself. Great Britain nearly bankrupt itself. And the United States was, in fact, bankrupt. And had it not been for financing from France and some from the Dutch, the American Revolution would not have been successful.
Although zoning obstacles and political battles have held up plans for building on private land within Valley Forge National Park, the center has a collection of thousands of objects assembled over the years by the Valley Forge Historical Society. The paintings, rare books, ceramics, silver, clothing, and weapons are for now living in a suburban warehouse, where on the day we visit, preparations are being made for the center's first major exhibition in collaboration with the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. Items loaned by the center include gunpowder cow horns engraved with folk art and French neck armor, as well as pistols, muskets, rifles, and swords. American Revolution Center Director of Collections and Interpretation, Scott Stevenson, says the weapons, like the other objects, provide insight into the stories of the people who use them. On the warehouse wall is a board with a mock-up of a display of a 4-foot-long musket.
This piece is significant because it's actually made in Philadelphia. This was a Philadelphia clock and watchmaker named Voigt, who supposedly actually maintained the clock in Independence Hall.
Across it lies a French model musket, which mounts a bayonet.
And it is an example of the perhaps 100,000 military arms that were sent to America to help secure American independence, and really highlights the crucial role that France played, not often remembered today, in bringing about American independence.
These two, with a third piece, a rifle made in the area of Reading, Pennsylvania, will be mounted on the wall crisscrossed, looking like the spokes of a wheel, highlighting certain details like engravings on the lock, and giving the display as a whole the look of, well, a work of art. Like the positioning of weaponry, the arrangement of work at the Academy also highlights the complexity of the American Revolution. One gallery is devoted to the conflict, with portraits of George Washington and George III facing off from opposite ends of the room. A second gallery explores the peace that came afterward and features a group portrait by Benjamin West depicting the American delegation that negotiated the Treaty of Paris, with a blank spot where the British are supposed to be standing.
There's an apocryphal story that they refused to sit for the painting. It's dramatic and interesting, but it happens not to be true. And to demonstrate that, we have a portrait of David Hartley. Hartley was very proud of his role as the British minister in negotiating peace with the United States. He was actually very sympathetic to the American cause.
Different perspectives on the war are explored in British political cartoons and a 1770 print of The Boston Massacre by Paul Revere. A silversmith by trade, but also, says David Brigham, an artist and an ardent patriot.
Revere had this print out on the street within days of the incident in 1770. It became a flashpoint in the revolution and really helped to catalyze support for people who might be wavering about where they stood in the spectrum of opinions.
Art may not be the first thing we associate with revolutionary times, but artwork, from formal portraits to political cartoons to prints handed out on the street, helped influence public opinions of the day, create symbols for a new nation, and shape the course of history.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Peace, Liberty, and Independence, 225 years after the Treaty of Paris, opens at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts on Friday and runs through October 12th. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Gigi Lam and Zian Mason. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at wrti.org. Reality Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore. And I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.